This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, Matt O'Lean reviews the new Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But first, in a land far, far from Hollywood, we are going to visit about the book Wainabosu, Man from God. The author is the Reverend Brian Knutson, who is active with First Lutheran Church in Williston. Reverend Knutson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Ashley.
What is Wainabosu about?
Oh, dear. That's a fun question. You know, and I should have anticipated that, I suppose. It is metaphor, analogy. It's a fun story. I wrote this, actually, when I was in seminary.
Hmm.
I went to Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I graduated in 1995, and my daughter was just a small little girl then, and I wrote it for her. And it has been sitting on the shelf, not going anywhere. So I wanted to write a story for her, a nature story, a faith story, an exploration story. And it was just a gift from a father to his daughter.
Hmm.
And it is the story of a curious loon who is out to seek and answer the question, where do I find the Great Spirit? How do I find the Great Spirit? And then has these delightful interactions with other forest creatures, and then eventually comes to meet Chief Bemidji. And they have this marvelous conversation and teach and share insight, and then finally comes to this delightful resolution about how one has to wait for the Great Spirit. So that's what it's about.
Yeah, well, it's an absolutely charming book, and that loon is so much like a young child, just full of questions. And there's this evolution of the learning process of the loon. I don't know if it's possible to say spoilers in a children's book, but I don't want to give away too much of the book. But
you
see the learning process of this loon, and you get a sense of how children are thinking. And the loon gets an answer from one animal, and then a different answer from a different animal, and then a different answer from a different animal. And you see the perspective change, and you see the learning change, and then, of course, meeting with a wise elder and being told to wait. Oh, it's really a charming book. But I do have to ask you, Wainabosu, that is a word from the Ojibwe Mohan language. Why did you want to write this book with an Ojibwe or from an Ojibwe perspective? That's not your cultural background.
Oh, dear, no. Oh, dear, no. You know, Knutson is about as Norwegian as I could be. Actually, it did come from a student lesson that my daughter was studying Native heritage in her elementary school outside of St. Paul. And so she brought home, actually, some lessons. And so we were, you know, looking at vocabulary list words and some of these other things, which were also animals and rice and, you know, just very basic vocabulary words. And so that was a part of how it came into that. And so, to be perfectly honest, I did not clear these vocabulary words with the Ojibwe people. And so that would be a very fascinating discussion to have, to see if I am, in fact, correct with these. And then, if so, that could that could open up more conversations.
What happened to your faith when you were writing this book? Did anything change for you?
That's really a marvelous question, Ashley. Well, yes. So that's my short answer. The longer answer is, you know, part of a seminary education is reading volumes of work by theologians, and it is amazing how complicated some of these great theological minds can be, and as they try to put these ideas down page after page after page, and to say, is there any way to make this a little more understandable and to comprehend this? And so I really did try to simplify it, you know. I mean, I think it was Einstein that said, if you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't know your subject well enough. Something like that.
Yeah, something. If you can explain it simply, that's when you understand it. I'm curious, and I'm not really sure how to ask this question very well, because one thing that we haven't studied a lot in this country that's been completely whitewashed over is the way that the indigenous people of this land were treated by the early European settlers, many of whom were missionaries and committed atrocities against the indigenous people in the name of a Christian God. And I'm wondering now, as a reverend, as a man of faith, and again, you're at First Lutheran Church in Williston, has that history been difficult one for you to reconcile now as we come to understand the legacy of that?
Oh, dear. Well, now you touch into, you know, my history side, and there really, honestly, is no quick answer for this. It is forgiveness. It is reconciliation. It is a seeking of understanding. It is what was once upon a time, and but I remember having these conversations with teachers and using that old language when Columbus came across to discover the New World, and they didn't discover anything because the people had been here for thousands of years, and here they just stumble across this and audacity to claim this as new. But it is a I don't know, a compelling conversation. But yet, when I was a boy, I went to my first powwow in Newtown, and it was fascinating to me. It was this combination of real life, this powwow happening right in front of my eyes. It was like seeing Hollywood unfolding right in front of me, and I have had this fascination with Native peoples truly my whole life. Dee Brown, I don't know if you remember the book Dee Brown, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. That when that book came out, I devoured it in the 1970s. So I have been on the periphery, I should say, wanting to learn more. I'm not really answering your question very well, am I?
Well, it's not exactly an easy question to answer. It could be.
I'm sorry.
No, I think you're doing a nice job. In the process of writing the book, I mean, anytime there is a novelist, you know, you ask, how do you get in the head of your character? And when you're speaking from the perspective of somebody very young, how did you go back to that mindset?
Well, I can say I wrote this thing in an afternoon sitting in the library on campus, and it just sort of happened, you know, as if some songwriters that can do that, and some of our great iconic music that was written in an afternoon, and it's funny how to say that it just comes together, but sometimes it truly does. But I mean, this is hardly a novel, hardly a novelist. It was just a cute little story, and I had some illustrations. I can't even say I'm much of an artist, but can I speak about Gail?
That's my next question.
Delightful. Gail is my wife's sister-in-law.
Okay, Gail Nelson. She illustrated the book
on a family tree. But we were all together a year ago at a family wedding, and it was the first time I had met Gail. And you know, she was by the way, Gail is an artist. She does. She's a very noted watercolorist. And I said, "Oh, really? How'd you like to illustrate a book?" And she said, "What is it?" And there it was. And I sent it to her on an email, and off it went. It was honestly, it was that silly of a serendipity moment. And Gail took off with this, and so she, you know, in a children's book, certainly it is the illustrations. And I believe that Gail has done an absolutely delightful and marvelous work. And so Gail does have other illustrations. She's done many, many other books, and she lives in Colorado. And so she has made this so easy. She is such a delight to work with. So I'm bragging about Gail. Gail Nelson is just a lovely person.
I'm really struck by the couple of times in this conversation you've mentioned something like serendipity or it just sort of happened. And I hear that so much from deeply spiritual people. So I just want to talk a little bit about the role of listening, tuning in and listening to a voice that, you know, it's not your mom saying eat your vegetables. It's a different kind of voice. Possibly
yes.
Led you to your calling. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
What does that voice sound like to you?
It sounds like the dove. And we have doves in the Midwest. Maybe I should learn more about doves. But the call of the bird, of the dove, is so very delicate. And oftentimes, you have to very intentionally tune into the call of the dove. Because it's so subtle and so delicate. And there it is. And then you see, you know, scripturally, symbolically, the dove does have a very prominent role in well, certainly Christian faith and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very, very delicate, and that's I believe often what it is. My dad thinks the dove is mournful. I don't at all. I think it's very, very delicate and very, very lovely. And you have to be very tuned in to listen to the dove. But for me, Ashley, that's what that voice sounds like.
Was it a straight path for you to become a reverend?
Oh dear, no. No. You know, but yet, perhaps my grandfather settled Homestead north of Williston in Alamo. So his homestead was there. My mom grew up in Rugby, and I have had cousins now in family, Kenmere, Stanley, Newtown. But my dad was a school teacher after World War II. He graduated from North Dakota State, and then he was a school teacher in Beach, and then he was a park ranger in Medora at Teddy Roosevelt Park. And then he taught freshman English back at North Dakota State. So I've lived pretty much all four corners of North Dakota. But I eventually graduated from high school and college out in Oregon. And all of my brothers and sisters, we were all born in a different state. And my father moved into government work, so he was transferred quite a bit. So that's how we moved all around. And I was a school teacher for a while. I was also in the Air Force for about 35 years, either active duty or reserve or guard time. And but once I put on an Air Force uniform, I never really took it off. I retired in 2014, and the opportunity opened up for me to come back to North Dakota. But I was a school teacher and an Air Force guy, and I worked as a firefighter for a while, and I drove a big truck for a while. So this, however, what was consistent was church for me and faith for me. And I, even as a little boy, I never had to struggle with the truth of it. I never had to think that the people in the stories that I was learning and reading, that they were not real people or that these events did not happen. He had me from the very beginning, and I was in. So I've loved the subject, and I love to share it from day one. It's really a joy.
The Reverend Brian Knutson of First Lutheran Church in Williston, the author of the book Wayna Boshu, Man from God, and maybe a second book about doves someday.
Why not? I'll talk to Gail.
Reverend Knutson, thank you so much for your time today.
Ashley, this was a delight. Thank you so very kindly for your time. Be well.
The book is available on Amazon. Coming up next on Prairie Public, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk to President Jefferson about his mail, dealing with religion, and one letter in particular.
A Washington Post article has recently unearthed a fabulous Jefferson letter written to a Miles King in September of 1814. King had real concerns about Jefferson's religious sensibility and his likelihood of eternal damnation. Jefferson replied to an 8,000-word screed. With respect and gracefulness and a magnanimity of spirit, Jefferson basically said, "You need not worry. Reason is my oracle. It's none of your business. If God wants to contact me, I know he will. Thank you for writing. You needn't fret anymore about my salvation."
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Presidential candidates are out in force across Iowa, meeting voters and finding out what's important to them. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports that it's an opportunity to get agricultural issues on the national agenda.
Iowa's first-in-the-country caucuses are less than 6 months away, and this time around, there's little competition on the Republican side. But more than 20 Democrats are vying for their party's nomination. University of Iowa political scientist Tim Hagel says it's a heady time to be an Iowa voter.
And the joke always is, you know, if you ask one person in Iowa, New Hampshire, have you decided on a candidate? No, I've only met them, you know, two or three times.
Iowa went twice for Barack Obama and then for Donald Trump. Democrats hope they can win Iowa again, so candidates are trying to attract voters who aren't committed to either party by showing they care about Iowa interests, like agriculture. On a hot 4th of July, a crowd mingled in a private yard ahead of California Senator Kamala Harris's stop in Indianola, a small city within commuting distance of Des Moines. Corn and soybean fields stretched around two sides of the property. Warren County boasts a couple of outlying suburbs of Des Moines, but most of it is still farmland. Kevin Peterson isn't registered with either party. He's listening to everyone. He says hot-button social issues probably aren't what he and his neighbors will base their decisions on.
The economic issues, when they're going to make a significant impact to a rural area or semi-rural area like Warren County, is probably going to sway things a lot more in 2020.
Peterson's not a farmer, but he wants to know what candidates plan to do about trade deals, which some argue have disproportionately hurt farmers. In Corn Belt states in particular, the slashing of soybean exports to China has stymied farm profits. Voter David Kitsis has seen the impact.
Farmers need help right now, big time. And the current administration's not doing it with the tariffs with China, and so we've got to get somebody else in there.
Harris came prepared to address Trump's ag policy, even referencing soybeans rotting in bins because farmers didn't have a market for them.
We've seen a president of the United States who came into office saying that he was going to protect farmers. Yet, he initiates trade policy by tweet.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar toured an Iowa ethanol plant in April and declared support for the renewable fuel standard, a law popular with farmers because of the demand it creates for their corn. In 2000, Republican candidate John McCain essentially skipped campaigning in Iowa because he opposed ethanol subsidies. Other candidates are taking on the merging of large agribusinesses. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says if she's elected president, she'll undo the completed Bayer-Monsanto merger.
Remember, you can continue to consider the monopolistic impact of these mergers even after they occur. So this is not one of those where, darn, now it's happened, and so there's nothing we can do but wring our hands.
In the July debates, agriculture came up only a few times. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan called for a more sustainable agricultural system, and former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke specifically mentioned cover crops and conservation easements. But the lack of primetime attention underscores the role of early state voters. Again, political scientist Tim Hagel.
It does give voters a chance to raise those issues before the candidates and give the candidates an opportunity to consider those issues that they might not consider in another state.
Hagel says that can result in pandering, but Iowans have a long memory for those caucus season promises. Obama, for instance, had a tough reelection campaign here.
He made an awful lot of promises as a candidate and was not able to follow through.
President Trump came out in favor of ethanol ahead of the 2016 Iowa caucus. He didn't win it, but Iowa's Republican senators have made a point to hold him to his commitment. Hagel says that's the sort of legacy the Iowa caucuses can foster. But it's not clear whether any issue will rise to that level for Democrats in 2020. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a public media collaboration focusing on America's ag and rural issues. Still to come on Main Street, we learn about the gut microbiome and how your gut health can impact your mental health. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. President Trump has announced his intentions to step up the trade war with China by imposing additional tariffs on Chinese products. North Dakota Farmers Union President Mark Watney says the question needs to be asked if the trade war is being fought in the right way.
You know, you can't just go this alone. You need to either shore up the relationship with all the other countries so that we can actually pressure China, or you need to step back and rethink how you're approaching this.
Watney says as the U.S. drags out the trade war, the rest of the world is moving ahead.
China just opened up more wheat sales to Russia. They're opening up countrywide all of Russia to bring soybeans in. Vladimir Putin's talking about expanding their exports into China. So we're going to be replaced as a marketer.
Watney says you don't have to look too far back when the U.S. took trade steps against Russia and we lost those markets. If the Trump administration follows through on its threat, the new tariffs could go into effect September 1st. And there were more opioid pills per person per year distributed in Adams County than any other North Dakota county between 2006 and 2012. According to data provided to the Washington Post by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, about 46 hydrocodone or oxycodone pills per person were delivered, the highest ratio in the state. State's Attorney Aaron Roseland says the figures may be inflated because the county is home to West River Health Services, which is a regional critical access hospital.
We haven't found distribution networks. We haven't found evidence of street sales. And one of the telling pieces of data that's within that report is it also has opioid overdose deaths. The ones that I looked at looked like Adams County was at zero.
According to the report, Gateway Health Mart, Pharmacy North, and Bismarck received the highest number of opioid pills, about 2,593,000. Statewide, there were nearly 89.5 million pills delivered. The figures are the most recently made available by the federal government. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
He had an auto repair business for 25 years, but Carl Allenby wanted to go back to school and wound up in a biology class.
It was the first day of class when I walked in there, in the first hour, that my life changed.
Once a mechanic, now a doctor. Carl Allenby's story, the Democratic candidates on climate, and all the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Scientists call the gut the second brain, and the two are intimately linked. Poor gut health can lead to poor physical and even mental health. Dr. Erica Ebel-Engel is the CEO and co-founder of Excella, a company that can send you an at-home test kit to see the diversity of your gut's microorganisms, or microbiome. She spoke recently at TEDx Fargo.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I am here today to talk to you about the importance of listening to your gut. Brief hello. I'm a 38-year-old entrepreneur, biochemist, went to MIT, BU School of Medicine, and I have decided to dedicate my life to studying the gut and the gut microbiome. 6 years ago, I even started a company to address this issue. I've been really fortunate over the last few years to have worked with professional athletes and professional athletic teams to try to improve their gut health because it's so intimately related to things like increasing performance, decreasing sickness, and improving recovery time. So why am I here today? Well, I'm here to talk to you about what I think is the most important organ, and that is the gut microbiome. So for those of you who don't know what the gut microbiome is, it's everything from your mouth to your colon, from entry to exit, all the bits in between. So your stomach, your small intestine, your large intestine, and all of the little critters that live in there. So bacteria, fungi, viruses, and cells. There are trillions of these little critters that are living in there. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but diversity is so important in the gut. So why is it important to have a healthy gut? Well, it's really important for long-term health. So if you have a healthy gut, you're going to feel more energetic. You're going to get sick less often. You're going to have better mental clarity and ultimately have better emotional well-being. Versus if you don't have a healthy gut, a lot of research is showing that this is related to things like autoimmune conditions, diabetes, neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's, and even emotional issues like anxiety and depression. So our theme for today is, you are what you eat. So you're probably sitting there thinking, yeah, you know, as a kid, my parents always used to tell me, you are what you eat, as they tried to foist broccoli off on me, or if you were really, really lucky, Brussels sprouts and other things like that. But the reality is, they're actually right. Eating poorly can do really two things. So the first, one, it can prevent you from getting the nutrients that you need to stay healthy. And second, it can actually damage and change the entire composition of your gut, which will render it unable to digest things properly and create the nutrients that you need to function. So today we're going to look at three molecules that you get from dietary intake. You have to eat these things. So the first is something called tryptophan. You've probably heard of this. Thanksgiving comes, everybody talks about the tryptophan-induced coma that happens after you have your food. It's found in turkey, but it's also found in things like eggs and chia seeds. So your body takes tryptophan and converts it into a lot of other really important molecules, two of which we're going to talk about today. So one called serotonin. Serotonin is something that makes you happy, super important, and something called melatonin, which actually helps you to sleep. So imagine if you don't have any tryptophan or you're not consuming enough tryptophan. Well, no matter how many roses or diamonds or chocolates your significant other brings you, it's just not going to make you happy, and that's kind of sad. Also, you won't be able to sleep, so you won't be able to count sheep at night. Another example is a compound called tyrosine. So tyrosine, another amino acid, is found in foods like almonds, but it's also found in lentils and seeds and edamame. Tyrosine is converted to a variety of really important things as well. So we'll talk about dopamine. Dopamine is a compound that you may have heard of, and it's essentially it motivates you to do stuff. So it's this initiative-oriented behavior that it helps to propel. And epinephrine, which is also known as adrenaline, the fight-or-flight molecule, which is really helpful when you're up on this stage. Imagine if you don't have these things. What would happen? Well, here's what would happen. One, you'd be drooling on your couch, or worse yet, if you were being chased by a mountain lion, which I'm sure, you know, who knows, may happen at some point in everybody's life, the emoji being, you don't want this to happen, right? You need a body to respond to these types of situations. Third, we're going to talk about something called indole 3-lactic acid. So it's really important. It's found in fermented foods, things like pickles, sauerkraut, kimchi, kefir. ILA is super important because your body takes it in, and there's certain bacteria in the gut that actually convert the ILA into something called IPA, indole propionic acid. That indole propionic acid is actually one of the strongest antioxidants in the body. And again, you guys might have heard of this word antioxidant, but I'll explain what it does. So in your body, you have a variety of different chemical processes that happen. Many of them create things called free radicals. These are bad. They're reactive species that go and damage your cells. They damage DNA. And then ultimately can lead to things like cancer. So these antioxidants come in and actually break down your free radicals, keeping you healthy longer. Clearly, eating certain types of foods is really necessary to keep you healthy, but it's not sufficient. A healthy microbiome is needed to be able to execute these conversion processes that we're talking about, to take things in, to digest them, and to spit out other molecules that are really important to your health. So let's talk a little bit about what makes a healthy microbiome. In a healthy gut, you have very diverse species in there. You have different bacteria, right? So you've got some that digest veggies, some that digest meats and breads and oils, and your gut is populated by many, many different types of things. Now let's say you decide that you are just going to eat foods that are really high in fat, things like hot dogs and ice cream and pizza, although pizza sounds really good right now. If you train your system to do this, your gut's going to start producing more and more of the type of bacteria that are used to seeing the kinds of foods that you eat. And eventually, you're going to skew the ratios. Those bacteria are going to outcompete the other types that are there because they're just not being used. And then you'll end up with a situation where you can have a very unhealthy, not diverse set of bacteria in your gut. Now, you might ask, can you reverse that? Yes, but it often takes a lot of time and energy to do. Sometimes you actually can't. Once those bacteria are gone, it's really tough to bring them back. What's really interesting is the body tries to actually generate the right building blocks, even if you've damaged your gut. Now, here's the sad part. Many of the things that we do in our life are, in fact, completely lethal to the microbiome. I love chips. Sadly, you don't find a lot of healthy stuff in most chips. You're not going to find tyrosine, tryptophan, or ILA here. Antibiotics, medicines, helpful, but they kill bacteria. And they don't just kill bad bacteria, they kill all bacteria. And so oftentimes, after you've gone through a course of antibiotics, you kill off your microbiome. Sometimes it never rebuilds properly again. Stress. You know, you hear this. Stress kills things, stress is bad. We could have a whole 30-minute talk on the impact of stress on the microbiome. Stress is, in fact, extremely bad for the microbiome. Your central nervous system, your brain, is intimately connected to your gut. The two talk back and forth to each other. Think about it. When you're stressed, you have a headache, you feel terrible. You often feel that stress in your stomach, butterflies in your stomach, anxiety. Sometimes you have to go to the bathroom more. The two talk to each other all the time. They're intimately connected. And so the more stressed you are, the more likely it is that you will damage your microbiome. And then lastly, we live in a very aseptic society. And this is bad. Decreases the diversity of bacteria in the gut. One of my favorite examples is back many years ago, kids would play in the dirt and they'd be exposed to all kinds of different things. Now, kids come inside, they watch TV, they play on their phones, and a lot of diseases are actually being connected to the lack of diversity in the gut. Things like autism, ADHD. So super important to get outside. So what can we do about this? Well, the good news is not all is lost. It is possible to improve your gut. And this is one of the things that I get to do every day, and I'm so fortunate in my job. My company actually is trying to measure the functional state of the gut, define what that is, and then to create interventions to improve it. We call this improving your internal fitness. So what are some simple things that you can do to help improve your gut? Well, one, we've talked about changing your diet. Two, we've talked about stress management techniques, incorporating mindfulness, meditation, breathing exercises to minimize your stress, or exercise is great. 15, 20 minutes of walking a day can help to keep you regular, mitigate your stress, and it can actually help to promote the growth of certain types of bacteria. And then lastly, targeted supplementation. I'm not saying to take lots of different supplements. I'm saying if there's certain things that your body needs, you might actually take a supplement. Sometimes there's a lot of fish that you have to eat in order to get the equivalency of one pill, but make sure it's what you need. So the next time that you're lying on the couch, feeling lethargic and not sure why, or you're sick for the fifth time in a year, listen to your gut. Thank you.
That was Dr. Erica Ebel-Engel, the CEO and co-founder of Excella, a company that studies the health of our microbiomes. She spoke at TEDx Fargo. Coming up next, Doug Hamilton visits with Matt Olien about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Have you ever felt anxious walking into a room full of strangers?
All the time.
What if you could reframe all those anxious feelings into something different?
I can sense my heart beating, but I definitely feel the surge of energy that is encouraging me to engage.
Ideas on how to be better, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at noon, 11 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Before highways, there were trails. And the Red Trail hails back to 1914. The Old Red Old 10 scenic byway between Mandan and Dickinson honors the early days of automobile travel. When you drive the Old Red Old 10, you will travel through scenic countryside at a leisurely pace and meet friendly folks as did early motorists. Find information about Old Highway 10 and Red Trail online at oldredold10.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien, and that fanfare sort of says it all because this is kind of a movie about the movies, Matt.
Yeah, it kind of is. Quentin Tarantino's ninth film he's directed, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, highly anticipated. Once I saw the first trailer to this months and months ago, I could not wait to see it. This is his film about sort of the Manson murders and sort of not the Manson murders. So that's you need to go see it to know what I'm talking about. But basically, this is probably my number one film of the year so far. I've blown hot and cold on Tarantino his whole career. You know, loved Inglourious Basterds, did not like The Hateful Eight, very up and down on Django Unchained. You know, Pulp Fiction's a masterpiece. But this is one of his most gentle films. The violence that he's known for is minimal. We don't have the usual lashings of violence. The dialogue is great as usual. No one's better at writing dialogue. Sometimes his scenes go on too long. He could use an editor, but he's an auteur. He can make whatever film he wants. But this is really an ode to L.A. Hollywood in the late 60s. So you have old Hollywood kind of ending and new Hollywood kind of taking over. You know, Roman Polanski he now lives in Hollywood. He's a part of this film, of course, married to Sharon Tate. He's a hot new director. But really the film centers around kind of this buddy bromance between Leonardo DiCaprio as Rick Dalton, kind of this has-been, past his prime, Western TV actor who tried to have a film career, and his stunt double, Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt. They are so good on screen together, Doug. It was one of the best buddy pairings I can remember in recent history. It almost feels like a throwback to those 50s and 60s, you know, two male stars on screen with that bonding thing going on. And Tarantino writes it like that, and they have some phenomenal chemistry together. These are two movie stars. You're watching two movie stars really do their thing. They're funny with each other. There's some touching scenes, some moving scenes. Now, how this frames with the Manson murders and the Manson family is interesting. What I can tell you is Dalton's character lives on Cielo Drive. Okay, he lives next to Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. That's about all I can tell you. How this intersects is a subject of controversy. The final act of the film is being much discussed. We're not going to do spoilers here. I liked how the film ended. Others have not liked how the film ended. Most critics have liked this film. A few have not. A few have had trouble with the ending of the film. I was totally okay with the ending of this film. But like I said, it's an ode to old Hollywood meeting new Hollywood. But also there's that underbelly, Doug, that underbelly of runaways, flower children, hippies flocking to Southern California in the late 60s, you know, for good purposes. But of course, the girls who fall under Manson's spell, Tex Watson, these people, that was the horrible underbelly and the tragedy that happened with the Tate-LaBianca murders.
Well, this is set 50 years ago, mm-hmm. 1969, the same year we landed on the moon, and all these horrible things mm-hmm. happened in Hollywood at that time. I lived out there just a few years after this, and I can tell you that Hollywood was not my cup of tea. It was nice weather, but kind of a nasty underbelly.
What Tarantino pulls off here is not only a humorous take with Pitt and DiCaprio, we have some great cameos. Damian Lewis shows up as Steve McQueen at the Playboy Mansion. You know, Tarantino loves throwing in these touches, these little scenes that don't really have anything to do with the plot, but yet they're entertaining. So I've never seen anybody imitate Steve McQueen, but Damian Lewis pulls it off. And McQueen was a friend of Polanski and Tate. That's a fascinating cameo. There's a great flashback scene with Brad Pitt's character kung fu fighting with Bruce Lee on the set of Green Hornet. That's a great scene that people are talking about. Julia Butters, 10-year-old actress, scene stealer, has these two scenes with DiCaprio. She's playing a Western girl in this Western. DiCaprio has a guest stint on the Western TV show Lancer, and she plays a little girl in the show, and they kind of have this scene where they're talking about things before the scene happens, and she is so engaging and so funny in the scene that she almost steals the scene from the great Leonardo DiCaprio. So look for those cameos as well. But there's this kind of soft underbelly of fear hanging over the film. There's a phenomenal scene where Brad Pitt does end up at the Spahn Ranch, where the Manson family lived.
Yes.
And the creepiness that hangs over that scene is really well done by Tarantino. Foreshadowing, is it not foreshadowing to what's going to happen at the end of the film? That's a really interesting scene. Pitt really gives a movie star performance. He's so super cool. He drives around Los Angeles. Some of the driving shots around L.A. are really good. You have the set design down to the detail of the times, Doug. You have the radio playing, you know, kind of that rock and roll DJ radio of the time. So the details are really good. Couple criticisms. Tarantino long been criticized for underwriting female characters. Margot Robbie is very good as Sharon Tate when she's on screen. I wanted a couple more scenes from her. You know, she's really engaging as Sharon Tate. You get a sense of this woman's life that was snuffed out way too early when she and her baby were killed by the Manson family. I wanted a few more scenes with Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate. That was my one criticism of the film. But the film is really built around Pitt and DiCaprio and how that intersects with the Manson family in the final act.
Well, there are a lot of stars in this film. You mentioned DiCaprio, Pitt, and Robbie. Emile Hirsch, Dakota Fanning, Bruce Dern, Timothy Oliphant, Al Pacino.
Yes, Al Pacino shows up as a movie producer who's offering DiCaprio the chance to go to Italy to shoot spaghetti westerns. So that's an interesting side note in this film as well. But I love the film. I know some people have not liked it so far, but generally the response has been good. It's so much better than The Hateful Eight, his kind of misfire 4 years ago that was set in like one set with this 70mm film that they used, which didn't work for me at all. But again, he can write dialogue like nobody's business. Could the film be edited a little bit? Yeah, it runs about 2 hours and 40 minutes. The film starts slowly, but it's like a slow burn buildup to what the final act is going to reveal.
So is this an Oscar film?
I think it is. I think it's the kind of film the Academy will like. Tarantino has 2 screenplay Oscars already. I see a 3rd directing nomination coming for him here, depending on what the rest of the year happens. You know, DiCaprio and Pitt are so good in this film. They could receive Oscar nominations. Not sure. It's way too early to predict that, but this is my favorite film of the year so far.
All right. Well, that leads me to our Oscar trivia question. And when you look at Once Upon a Time on IMDb, the movie database that's online that has everything, you get 26 returns. Now, some of those are for a TV series, but there were several movies that were Once Upon a Time, including one that was a spaghetti western that was set 1 year before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It had 2 well-known stars.
It was filmed the year before. It wasn't set that.
Yeah, correct.
Set
yes.
in the West, right?
Yes, that's right. It was set in the Old West. It was filmed in 1968.
Yep.
It had 2 stars in it who were known on stage and in the cinema who won Academy Awards. Not for this film. But who were they?
Jason Robards and Henry Fonda.
Okay.
Would have been Once Upon a Time in the West, directed by Sergio Leone.
That's right. Clint Eastwood wouldn't show up in it because Charles Bronson got the role.
Bronson got the role, and that really made him a star.
So Jason Robards won his Academy Awards for?
Yeah, back-to-back supporting actor, All the President's Men in 76 and Julia in 77. And Fonda, on his deathbed, unfortunately, got the Oscar for On Golden Pond as he was ailing and dying.
And the year before, the honorary award.
Yes, he did get an honorary award.
All right, we've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
What if we told you that the time your internet went down?
People just assume that, my internet went down for 5 minutes.
Or the time your cell phone went berserk.
My phone has been goofed.
Or your car brakes stopped working.
I can't slow down.
That it was caused by
a zing from deep space?
A cosmic ray from a distant star.
Great Scott!
Galactic Gremlins on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 2nd. Although it is a landlocked state, North Dakota has a connection to the sea thanks to James J. Hill. On this date in 1901, the Oaks Republican announced that the Great Northern Steamship Company had acquired the use of 2 ships from Dodwell and Company. The city of Seattle had already been delivered, and the paperwork for the Duke of Fife would be completed on August 5th. Dodwell and Company would continue to operate the ships as an agent of the Great Northern Steamship Company. The Great Northern had acquired the use of 17 ships. James J. Hill was known as a shrewd businessman. He saw an opportunity to expand his passenger business from land to sea to complement his railroads. Besides chartering the Dodwell ships, he ordered 2 ships from the Eastern Shipbuilding Company in New London, Connecticut. The Minnesota and the Dakota were scheduled to provide passenger service between Portland, Oregon, and Japan. They were completed in 1904 and 1905. At over 20,000 tons, they were the largest passenger vessels built in the United States. In 1914, Hill established a second line with an almost identical name, the Great Northern Pacific Steamship Company. This line also ran out of Portland, operating two ships. The purpose was to compete with the railroad lines running between Portland and San Francisco. During the winter of 1914 and 1915, the Great Northern Pacific also provided service between the mainland and Hawaii. The Great Northern Steamship Company operated from 1900 to 1914. The Great Northern Pacific Steamship Company lasted until 1918. Although Hill actively advertised and promoted both lines, neither was a success. By the time World War I broke out, the Great Northern Pacific was on its last legs. Hill put it up for sale. The United States government commandeered his last two ships for the war effort. While Hill was a railroad wizard, he had little understanding of the sea trade. By the time he called it quits with the sea, his business losses amounted to almost $3 million. That would be about $65 million today. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Dakota Datebook finally has a book, and we're going to launch it, quite literally, with a sunset riverboat cruise. Join Prairie Public aboard the Lewis and Clark Riverboat. We'll set sail from Bismarck Saturday, August 24th at 8 p.m. You'll be first to be able to get your hands and lay eyes on this treasure trove of North Dakota history. The Dakota Datebook book, prepared by a University of North Dakota practicum and the UND Digital Press, features specially selected datebooks for each day of the year. So practice your best Meadow Lark whistle. That was good. And get aboard the Lewis and Clark with Dakota Datebook founder Bill Thomas and State Historical Society Director Claudia Burr. Saturday, August 24th, we'll set sail at 8 p.m. Central. Tickets are $15 in advance, $20 at the dock. Go to prairiepublic.org to reserve yours now and to place an advance order of Dakota Datebook North Dakota Stories from Prairie Public. Or you can call 800-359-6900. So sail the majestic Missouri with Prairie Public and celebrate a collection as unique as the state whose stories it tells.
This week, Away With Words is going to be off the chain.
Now, I'm a private pilot, and I know on Halloween there's witches with brooms and whatnot, and I was wondering if maybe Fly Off the Handle came from a witch flying off the handle of her broom.
I've never heard of that anywhere before except from my mother.
Join us.
That's why I figured I'd ask the real experts.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, I hope you get to spend a lot of time in the yard doing some gardening or even just looking at your garden. And while you're there, try and get some questions for Ron Smith. He will be live in studio on Monday. Send your questions ahead of time to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Until then, enjoy your weekend.